We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from Wild Turkey Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey. Let's tune in to their one-on-one with Jamal, a real bartender from Old Fourth Ward in Atlanta.
I really get into the backstory of whatever I'm pouring. Out of respect, there are literally years of experience behind these bottles. Wild Turkey, same recipe since 1942. If you want a true classic, this is what you want to order.
Wild Turkey. Wild Turkey Distilling Company, Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Copyright 2020, Campari America, New York, New York. Never compromise, drink responsibly.
Welcome in to the RotoWire NFL podcast for Thursday, December 31st, New Year's Eve, the final day of 2020. We are getting ready for week 17 of the NFL action. I'm your host, John McKechnie, joined as always by Mario Puig. We have a ton to get to. There are a lot of seeding situations still up for grabs, some playoff spots still up for grabs. So a lot of teams with a lot to play for this weekend. But week 17, as always, it's got some wild names that are going to be on the fantasy radar, potentially determining your fantasy championships if you play into week 17. And it also creates a very fun, interesting situation for DFS purposes as well, of course. That's my favorite thing to do for week 17. Before we get into it, Mario, how did you finish out as far as your season-long leagues were concerned? How'd you do in that Dynasty Championship?
Well, I lost to Jake. He didn't end up getting that big game from Henry. He got a big one from Taylor, though, and some receiver. I can't remember. My team is just ravaged at this point. Like I was starting like my running back six or something. I had Edwards-Helaire, James Robinson, and then also Will Fuller was a big part of my otherwise good season. So him being suspended, those two running backs being out, there's some other kind of nonsense that I can't remember, but yeah, just stumbled. Like I was just limping through and all my playoff teams that made the playoffs. And yeah, at Stake League, I went against Parr, who had like 170 points. And I didn't limp to the finish line. I limped a long time before it and fell over some distance short.
Did not quite finish the race. Yeah, but that happened to me in a couple spots. The one big league that I was able to take home the championship in, I, of course, was the beneficiary of Alvin Kamara's Christmas Day.
Oh, nice.
Six touchdown performance. Really, I had a lot of other kind of mediocre to bad performances elsewhere on that team, but Kamara really helped smooth a lot of that over.
That's
I had Le'Veon Bell coming in.
Yeah,
yeah, that will just kind of fix whatever ails you. So that was able to carry me to the ship in that one. So that's 2 years in a row where the teams where I've had Alvin Kamara, and I ended up winning. So I'm going to have to rehash that strategy again in 21. But let's go ahead. Let's dive in. Week 17, last week of the regular season. We'll kick things off in Foxborough. We've got the Jets going up against the Patriots. Expectation is that Cam Newton will remain the starter. As of the time that we're recording this one, the Patriots 3-point favorites against those red hot New York Jets. What's going on here from a fantasy perspective, Mario?
Probably not much. I guess there might be something in some running game here, but it's hard to imagine anyone throwing in this game. Maybe if Cam's still three down player the whole game, maybe he can do something against this Jets secondary. Like, Bryce Hall looks pretty good. I don't know if Javelin Guidry's still out, but they just are running kind of like a practice squad secondary, which means there might be a chance for New England's practice squad receivers to get open a little bit. Jacoby Myers is not just a practice squad player. Of course, he's good. But, yeah, it's obviously Cam has his actual issues to deal with, too. It's not just that his receiving group is bad, but I just don't know if they're actually bad in this matchup. So if Cam can't do anything here, then I might blame him for this game, even though I'm prepared to make excuses for some other parts of the way his season has gone.
Oh, for sure. But yeah, a spot against the Jets here, who, you know, should be trying to lose, obviously have won two straight. You know, this should be a spot for him to have some success. On the Jets side, like you mentioned, neither team might be able to get a ton going through the air. But I mean, we saw, you know, some big plays being made in the Buffalo passing game against the Patriots that did not have Stephon Gilmore. Is there anyone on the Jets that could potentially, you know, challenge what these Patriots are doing defensively?
I don't really see it. I think that the Patriots kind of just fell apart over the course of that game, and Dable made some kind of adjustment at halftime where Diggs went nuts in the second half. I think what you saw was kind of Dable making an adjustment in the second half that the Patriots just didn't really have a response to, especially when you're talking about a receiver like Diggs. So I don't think that it's easy to go against that Patriots defense. I think it's just the Bills have a lot of ammo in every sense, coaching, personnel-wise, that the Jets don't have. So I think I like Sam Darnold. I know that this is insane to a lot of people, but I'm just not really willing to open a discussion on it. Like, I think Darnold's good. I think the Jets are the problem here.
Yes.
But they're still the problem here. And the Patriots, you know, they'll lose to the Brian Dable peak Bills. But if you're a normal team, you're probably not going to do that well against them. And when you're a bad team, you're probably going to do quite poorly against them.
Yeah, and touching on that Brian Dable halftime adjustment detail, that's the second time, and I paid the most attention to the Bills on those nationally televised games. But yeah, against Pittsburgh, you know, he found something in that Steelers defense to where Diggs just absolutely dominated and took that game over in the second half, and we saw it again, like you said, on Monday night. So interesting detail just for the Bills moving forward. For as long as Dable is there, he'll obviously be a big time head coaching candidate. But anything else to add on to this Jets Patriots game before we move on?
No.
All right, same. Let's go Vikings Lions. So this is one of those Week 17 games where there's just a whole mess of guys that you may or may not have heard of before that are going to be fantasy relevant in this one. Obviously, on the Lions side, Matthew Stafford is dinged up. Kenny Golladay is not going to be playing, so that puts a cap on what's been a lost season for him. On the Vikings side, Dalvin Cook away from the team following a death in the family, tragic death in the family, of course. So he will not be playing in Week 17. So that makes guys like Mike Boone and Alexander Mattison back on the radar for this one. Amir Abdullah potentially as well. So let's go ahead and unpack this one from the fantasy perspective as far as what you're looking at in this Detroit Vikings matchup that's a little bit topsy-turvy.
Yeah, I guess I would expect Minnesota to take it seriously at the coaching level just because Mike Zimmer has a reputation to tend to. It's not doing as well these days, and who knows, it might be maybe it won't matter what happens with this game, but if they come out and look flat against the Lions, maybe all of a sudden there's some sort of renewed, more focused effort to get Zimmer fired. And maybe if they win a game like this soundly, he can keep the kind of dimmer Vikings fans believing like, see, this, we were close this year. We just had some bad luck. I think if we stick with Coach Mike, we can really get it in 2021. All we need is whatever, you know, we just need Daniil Hunter back or whatever. But if they lose this game to the Chase Daniel just idiot Lions, no one's going to feel that way about Zimmer, you know. So I think that Madison should set up for a pretty big game if the usage is there. I don't know how much of a given the usage is. Against this Lions defense, especially, guys like Boone and even Amir Abdullah definitely can move the ball. So I don't think they need Madison to do anything. But, you know, if they want to go with him, he should roll, because this Lions defense is really bad. And in a matchup like this, to have Kirk Cousins and those Vikings receivers versus, you know, the cumulative effort of the Lions and the kind of field positioning and script setups that they're likely to give the Vikings, it should be totally in control for the Vikings to just run the ball at will.
I think so too. You know,
I do like Swift on the other side though, if okay. Kendricks is out.
Sure. No, that's a huge detail, of course. But yeah, when it comes to the Vikings, like if you are playing out the week 17, like would you feel confident in starting someone like a Madison as like your RB2?
Yeah, with so many guys down too, it's like I've never felt this disoriented at the end of a regular season. Just like, I mean, COVID's part of it, of course. So sure. If you got a guy who's expected as a starter for a team that's a 7-point favorite over a run defense as bad as the Lions, something could still go wrong, of course, in the way that anything could. But as far as details that you can actually know and control ahead of time, it doesn't really get much more of a green light.
No, definitely not. And then on the Lions side, if it is Chase Daniel, David Blauwett, whatever it may be, instead of Matthew Stafford, are you in kind of like need to bench mode for guys like Marvin Jones, Mohamed Sanu?
Not really. I don't know what to make of the Sanu thing. I hate how they're trying to make their offense as slow as possible with those receivers. Like, we got to get everybody who runs a 4.7. If you're faster than that, you're hitting the bench. But I think that Marvin Jones, you know, it's like he's still okay, and he knows how to play a receiver. These rookie corners for the Vikings probably can't match his overall savvy or whatever, even if he's not an imposing athlete, and even if he has a bad quarterback throwing to him. So I think you can feel optimistic about that. And for whatever it's worth, I'm pretty sure the Lions do have an interest in feeding Marvin Jones because he's a free agent. So if they can keep his free agency value alive, they might be able to get like a fifth round, sixth round comp pick out of it. And, you know, either way, it's like they're not, they have a reason to try to drive up his price tag, basically. And it's like, who else is going to play in the meantime? It's not like they need, for evaluation purposes, to go with anyone else instead. So they could do that, because I don't trust any, like the Lions, I don't trust to be well run, even if Patricia's gone. Like it seems, in fact, like they're quite, like that Marvin Hall cut, like that's a team that doesn't know what they're doing. They don't think, quite specifically, they're not thinking about their comp pick situation, their free agency situation. So they might throw Jones like on the bench or something for some, you know, ridiculous short-sighted reason. But they should try to feed him, because if he gets a decent contract and a starting role, they might get a free draft pick out of it.
Absolutely. So hopefully that, you know, it would be counter to the precedent they set earlier this year, like you said, with the Marvin Hall thing, but maybe they come to their senses a little bit and keep Marvin Jones fixed in the game plan for this weekend. Let's go over to Dolphins versus the Bills. This game obviously has some playoff implications to it. The Bills currently sitting in the two spot in the AFC. The Chiefs obviously have the number one spot wrapped up. The Bills also have the head-to-head tiebreaker over the Steelers. So the Steelers not using Ben Roethlisberger on Sunday, so it's almost like a gentleman's concession that they might lose this one. And the Bills will be playing against a Dolphins team that obviously needs to get a win to remain in the playoff picture. Given all the other, everyone is like 10-5 in the AFC. It is a totally jumbled mess right now. But I expect this one to be a 60-minute game for you know, on both sides of this one. Could be wrong, but we'll see. You know, maybe the Bills start scoreboard watching and you know, start to rest guys like Diggs and Josh Allen down the stretch of this game. But as it stands, I think that I'm approaching this game as a normal one as far as my Bills guys are concerned.
Yeah, and I know that the Steelers might think that they're conceding by putting Roethlisberger on the bench, but Rudolph, I mean, I hate the guy, he sucks, but he cannot be worse than Roethlisberger has been this year. Like, Devlin Hodges cannot be worse than Roethlisberger has been this year. It's memorable how bad he's been. But in this particular game, it'll be interesting because it seems like some of the betting money is thinking the Bills do rest their guys, or I don't know how else it goes from 5.5 Bills to the over-under falling 4 points and then 1.5 Bills. I don't think four quarters of Josh Allen and the fully focused Brian Daboll offense are what I don't think that's compatible with that sort of like outcome for that game. So we'll see. I think that the like generally people would have been assuming like, oh, Josh Allen's going to kill the Dolphins because he killed them back in week two or whatever. And this Miami defense is probably quite a bit different than it was at the time. Like not just in terms of like the approaches that they're using or like the quality of the play. It's like they've got different personnel. They kind of have different ideas of who their best players are. Different guys are featured than were featured back in certainly September. The players in that scheme are better at it now. Like there's a point probably around like week five or six where you could tell the Dolphins kind of just started to learn the coverages that the Dolphins were going for. And when you have a bunch of free agents, a bunch of new draft picks, it's not easy to do that in the first month of the year, especially with the weird offseason that we had this year. So that Miami defense is dangerous, and it's specifically dangerous to a guy like Josh Allen at this point, because I know Josh Allen's doing really well, but it's like if you're watching the games and the way this guy plays, I think it's pretty clear that Stephon Diggs and Brian Daboll are kind of smoothing some of the rougher edges. And you know, a guy plays like last week where it's like throws an interception and there's an offsides on the play. There's I feel like 2 weeks ago there was a couple sequences too where it was like very like it ended up being touchdown drives for the Bills, but there were like near disasters at several points before. Sure. And like Allen has that disaster ability when the script goes some way that he doesn't foresee and like one that Daboll can't protect him from. So if they get surprised by these coverages and Allen's not seeing things right, he can just go into a shell. And then as the Pittsburgh game and this most recent Patriots game showed, Daboll will probably figure something out in the second half if they want to, if they care enough to try. So I don't know. That's like enough sort of conditional statements that don't normally apply to the Bills that I am not as I can definitely see like why the spread is going down the way it is. It's just that if those people are betting on four quarters from Allen, that seems kind of wrong. So I don't know if Buffalo just kind of okay with losing this one? Because I don't think they lose it unless they're kind of okay with it.
Right. No, exactly. Yeah. If they show up, I think that they're winning this game, especially, you know, you're the Bills. It's January, Orchard Park, and you have the Dolphins visiting. Like, I think that, you know, that they should be able to take care of business if they really feel compelled to. And I'm sensing that they are. But, you know, again, like you said, that the betting market paints a slightly different picture, one that's a little bit rosier on the side of the Dolphins. When it comes to the Dolphins in this one, I know that the Bills, especially earlier on in the season, their defense was one that was underperforming. I think one that, you know, it was not consistent with the brand that their defense had kind of earned for itself over the last couple of seasons. But they've tightened up, I would say, over the last month or so of the season. I think they've been playing a whole lot better. So I like the Bills to be able to stifle this Dolphins offense. And I think also, I mean, I'm losing my faith in Tua Tagovailoa already a little bit.
I'm not. I think the Dolphins are doing a weird thing.
They are.
The way they're managing him is weird and novel and stuff, but I think it makes some sense. I think it's just that their overall premise, you know, their overall logic, you know, strategy here is a little incoherent. And I think it's incoherent in that, like, they just should have left Tua on the bench the whole time. I know why they wanted to go to him. They went into this year believing, we should get Tua on the field. We got to find a time to get Tua on the field. Why not after the bye? That way he gets time to be ready and we give him a fair shot or something. And it's like, you're forgetting one thing. Your offensive line absolutely does not give him a fair shot no matter what time you put him on the field this year. Your offensive line is not good enough for a rookie to be in like a safe setting. So if you're pursuing this logic of like a safe setting for him, you have to just let it go. It's not actually going to be an option. If you're putting him on the field, it's because you should be prepared for the fact that you're throwing him into the fire. You should understand it in those terms. And they seem to be getting caught off guard by that being the case, which is, it's not the most reassuring thing, because it shows they, you know, basically don't know what's going on. But I think that Tua is in a difficult spot, because that offensive line, like, it was supposed to be bad with Austin Jackson. He hasn't played this year, basically, if I remember right. The rest of the they need like at least three new starters on that offensive line. And so when they say we went to Fitzpatrick in this game because we needed to start throwing deep, I get it, because I think it's them going back to the logic of Fitzpatrick starting this year, which is like, we put him out there as a human shield for when Tua is going to get beat up from playing otherwise. And it's like, you are right to feel that way about these first six games or whatever it was, but you should also know it's going to be that way for the next 10 too. Mm-hmm. So they're sort of being caught off guard by that is the weird part to me. But I do think it makes sense. Like, these deeper drops, these catch-up situations, like, that offensive line is going to make it hard on whoever the quarterback is. So you better put out some guy who doesn't care if he gets lit up and you know, is okay with just chucking the ball when he doesn't know what he's looking at. Because Tua, you know, being a rookie, if he tries to do the things Fitzpatrick does, it's like the coaches are rightly criticizing him, because you shouldn't be like Fitzpatrick. But with Fitzpatrick, it's just kind of baked in. They're like, oh yeah, he's the hooligan quarterback. You put him out there to make a circus happen when you can't win. And it's like, you know, to be fair, that's kind of, he's fulfilling that role. It's just kind of a ridiculous role to have.
It's not a role that usually exists on a team that's pushing for a playoff spot, you know?
Right. And for me, it was just kind of like, just either go with the human shield or get an offensive line that can protect your quarterback. And they tried to have it both ways for some reason.
Yeah, and it's created a strange rotation, and Tua's had some very strange stat lines. You know, 145 yards on 26 attempts against the Patriots, 94 yards.
He has no help, though, you know? No. It's like, I wasn't exactly a fan of his as a prospect, but I'm not considering these past 4 weeks or whatever pertinent at all. Like, it's kind of like a Darnold thing for me. It's like, this is just a botched sample. There's nothing you can take from this. It's just tainted.
Okay, I see what you mean. In that sense, when it comes to the Dolphins from like a fantasy perspective heading into this game against the Bills, you know, we did mention that not a ton of help as far as what Tua has been working with. But do you like anybody, you know, as far as your starters are concerned? Are you more going after the Dolphins backfield in this one potentially? How do you see this from a fantasy angle?
Well, Miles Gaskin seems pretty good. I know Salvin Ahmed seems pretty good too, but Gaskin had that big pass catching game last week. And now I know people might look at his box score and think like, oh, well, that's an anomaly. Normally he's not very good. But I think you had sort of signs of a breakout game like that in the stat sample before that game for Gaskin, because all year he's been getting a pretty high target volume and there wasn't any explosiveness there. But one thing that was interesting was, in this high volume capacity, he was catching like 82% of his targets or something like that. So it's like, people look at 6 yards a target or 5.8 yards per target and understandably just keep scrolling. They're like, oh, this guy, you know, plotter, whatever. And it's like, actually, for playing that role in this offense that isn't very good, when you consider the resources and the bandwidth that the defense is probably devoting to Gaskin, that's actually really impressive that he was putting up numbers like that. And it was the kind of thing that was like, well, if the conditions get more favorable, he could maybe, you know, he could at the very least kind of leverage like 5 catch percentage points for like another yard of yards per target, something like that. Like, when you're well over 80 in the catch rate, it's like you can there's room for the numbers to kind of correct, and the regression to the mean might actually be a gain of some kind. So yeah, he had that big game, and now it's like his numbers are more correct, I feel like, over the whole course of the year. And you can kind of look at his averages now and think that's who he is rather than the first 8 games or whatever. But Gaskin looks good, and Ahmed, he did well, but when you're a sub 200 pounder and you're a speed back, like, it's going to be tough for him to take that workhorse distinction from Gaskin for the exact same reasons that it was when they were both at Washington.
No, that's a great point on that. Yeah, Gaskin great college player, obviously, at Washington. Ahmed, always kind of tabbed as this really high ceiling guy that never quite hit it in college. That's why he, you know, ended up in the draft situation that he was. But, you know, I think he's a viable NFL talent, but Gaskin the better one, at least at this stage. So, yeah, he's someone that you can probably feel comfortable with starting this week. Let's go over to the Bengals hosting the Ravens. Ravens 12.5 point favorites in this one, opened up at 11.5. Ravens need to win in order to lock down their postseason. But if they win, then they're in. So they control their own destiny in that respect. The Bengals, though, I mean, they're showing a little bit of late season backbone, a la the Jets a little bit. I mean, they're on a backup quarterback, obviously, in Brandon Allen, and you know they beat the Steelers with Ryan Finley a couple weeks back as well. So I don't think that they're a team necessarily to be taken lightly, especially the Bengals. Oh. They know they can play spoiler in this one, and you know. I think there is something to play for. The Bengals did play spoiler against the Ravens at the end of the 2017 season as well and knocked the Ravens out of the postseason there too. So a lot of things to keep in mind for this one, but how do you see this one shaking out?
Well, Baltimore should be fine, but like you said, the Bengals will make them actually earn it. It's not going to be a laying down for the Ravens to get this win. It's going to like that 13 points seems like a lot to me. I feel like the Ravens defense, of course, does have the advantage over this Cincinnati offense, even though Brandon Allen did well last week. But I don't feel like the spread is acknowledging the fact that Brandon Allen is a lot better than Ryan Finley. And if Brandon Allen's out there, T. Higgins has a shot in a way that he doesn't normally. And when you have a star player like him who's kind of in play, especially relative to a scenario where I think with Finley he basically wouldn't be, that's a huge distinction for how I imagine the Bengals going against the Ravens overall, just because I think Higgins can be a guy who takes over games. And in this case, it's not likely that he takes over the game, but he could make it go less the way people have reason to believe at a glance. Like he can just kind of disrupt the narrative for this game a little bit. So I think that I really hate the way the Ravens are running their offense. I think it's clear they don't know what they're doing and that Lamar is basically carrying them. But I think going with Miles Boykin at left receiver and taking Devin Duvernay out of the offense, like you're playing 10 on 11 right now. But the good news is going against Cincinnati, playing Miles Boykin against William Jackson is kind of just, you know, nothing's happening there anyway. But it makes it that much more important that the Marquise Brown and the Mark Andrews targets land, because if they don't, you missed that chance to land it, and you're probably going to see something like a double team if you try to run a look like that in the future. So then you're down to just like overpowering them in the run game, which might be easier said than done. So there's some ways for Baltimore to feel some heat in this game, and I definitely don't want to take that 13 points, although I do expect them to eventually win the game.
Yes, I do too. I think I saw a stat from earlier this week that the Ravens are something like 40-0 in the regular season when favored by double digits. But you know that this is not a game for them to take lightly, like you said.
People are not grasping how good T. Higgins is either. Like I keep seeing, like, oh, he's having a good rookie year. He's making it interesting with Justin Jefferson. It's like I know Justin Jefferson's having an insane year and he is really good, but I would still take T over. I would take T over him now after previously being lower on T than the two of them. What he's doing in that offense with how bad the quarterback play is, not that it was bad with Burrow, it was just stressed with Burrow. Yeah. Higgins is a star receiver. Like he might be a top like 7 or 8 receiver right now.
There we go. And you know, it's worth noting that Marlon Humphrey, Marcus Peters, and Jimmy Smith, all questionable.
So. Yeah, that's and the thing is, Humphrey on Higgins, I think I take Higgins to win that just because they don't give Humphrey much help either, you know? So it's like he's going to get the highest difficulty, the least help. And it's like T. Higgins is not a guy you play like that in the long term. No one will play T. Higgins that way in a year.
Right. No, that he is really coming on strong. And like you said, he's about to really kind of put himself in that household name type of category. So that's definitely a tough matchup for Humphrey if he has to shadow him. So yeah, either way, that's going to be one of the key matchups that, that could kind of make or break this one, and definitely like Higgins to perform well if your fantasy leagues are still going into week 17. Let's get on over to, or did you have anything to add to the Ravens backfield, as I guess, before we head on?
They all should be good, but that's also the problem in it.
Yes, always seems to be. Yeah, you can have a difficult time projecting how it's going to shake out one way or the other. Let's go over to Browns versus Steelers. So again, the Browns, now in light of the news that Roethlisberger will not be playing in this one, the Browns going at 9-point favorites, according to the DraftKings sportsbook, going up against the Steelers.
Yeah, that feels like a lot of points to me, just because I don't think the Browns are that good. And I'm going to, until further notice, give them kind of the Browns bounce presumption, i.e. like they'll just kind of be, there'll always be some sort of like failure factor with them, especially when the stakes get higher, especially when people start to believe like maybe the Browns are good now. I think that's when they become the Browns again. And so it's, as a general rule anyway, I'm not like specifically saying they're going to blow this game, but like I, as far as teams who could blow it this week, I would give the Browns, you know, top suspect category, because it's, you know, Baker Mayfield, maybe he'll still be a decent starter, but he is, at the very least in the meantime, very delicate. And if the script goes, and by the script, I don't mean like the passing volume. I mean, if the terms of his pass attempts aren't consistently in favorable terms for him, he can just kind of train wreck. And yes. I know that the Steelers defense is withered down, but I just think that even the Steelers at like 80% defense generally should be considered a favorite over Mayfield if he has to carry the game. So they need the running game to work, and it probably will. Chubb, especially if you let Chubb get to 20 carries, it's like there just seems to be a rule like gravity. You know, by that 20th carry, he will have broken like a 40-yard carry on you. And if especially if it's like your defense is spending a long time on the field per drive, it's like that moment comes sooner than you think. So they got to make sure that they keep Chubb's carry count contained somehow, either by keeping their offense on the field or baiting the Browns into throwing non-play action passes and bringing out the worst of Mayfield in doing so. But yeah, if Chubb gets his carries, I don't think any defense can stop him over 20 attempts most cases.
No, I don't think so either, and that still applies even to a defense as good as Pittsburgh's. I think one of the bigger storylines that we'll have to pay attention to when it comes to this Browns offense entirely is when these receivers come off the COVID list. That was obviously such a limiting factor for them Sunday against the Jets, but you know, Jarvis Landry should be ready to roll. Rashard Higgins, Kadarius Hodge, Donovan Peoples-Jones as well. Assuming that Mayfield has those guys back there with him, is there any reason for optimism from there? I know that we just mentioned where things really do need to be going in Mayfield's favor in order for him to have any sort of success, it feels like. But do you think that getting a healthy group of receivers that are legitimate NFL players can be something that fits that condition?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that as bad as that situation was for Mayfield last week, he still should have played better. Like, I still think that even if it's Marvin Hall and it's Jamarcus Bradley, it's like the Jets have the Jamarcus Bradley of corners playing right now. So how is that an excuse? I don't really see it. But in any case, Jarvis Landry, Rashard Higgins, Donovan Peoples-Jones are big upgrades, and they are, you know, familiar with Mayfield, having practiced with him all year. So That will help, definitely. I don't really want to recommend any of them, because I think it's one of those things where it's like Mayfield won't play very well. The volume won't be very big. So if any of Landry or Higgins or Donovan Peoples-Jones have a good game, it'll be because they probably stumbled into a touchdown or two for reasons that have to do with the overall current of the game and not really much to do with them or their matchups. Like it'll be more like a reflection of Cleveland logged, 15 snaps within the Pittsburgh 30. So Jarvis Landry got kind of like a guy slipped in coverage off the bootleg kind of touchdown, that sort of thing.
Okay. All right. That definitely checks out. And then let's get into like the fantasy impact on the Steelers side of it with Roethlisberger being out. So I know we've established that Roethlisberger has played in an extremely low level, especially down the stretch here. If you have a Juju Smith-Schuster, if you have a Deontay Johnson, can you trust throwing them out there with Mason Rudolph?
I don't really want to say trust, but if you could have trusted Roethlisberger at any point this year, then yes. It's like Rudolph's probably terrible, but these receivers, as they've come to be understood as 2020 fantasy assets, should still maintain their general nature. Like, I don't think Rudolph harms that, especially the way that he would harm it, though, if he did, I think has to do with the way he spreads out the targets. And I know a lot of people who don't understand anything about football watch Deontay Johnson, or probably don't watch him. They probably just look at his numbers.
They look at the dots.
They look at the target count, and their PPR ka-ching noise in their head goes off for every single one, and they're just zonked out on this high of seeing so many targets, which is just the most beautiful thing to witness. But if you actually watch the game and know anything, any of the significance of the events that are occurring, you would look at that and say, like, oh, the quarterback is bad and he can't throw it to like 80% of the field in any practical play setup. It's like Roethlisberger he can make throws in 7-on-7s over the middle and stuff like that, but to do it in a real game, he basically needs some sliders to be put in. He needs like the linebacker coverage slider to be down to like 50% or something, because it's he needs like more wind up space. He needs more time to process things. He needs more time to set his feet and then reset them when he's trying to orient himself toward a certain angle on the field. And all these things just aren't possible for him anymore. So he looks at the snap and he correctly still understands. He still understands everything that's going on. It's not like Roethlisberger's dumb in this state. He knows he can't do anything. So he correctly concludes early in most plays, like, I guess I got to throw it at Deontay over here because, no one's over there. And that's the offense. That's how it works. So I think Rudolph stepping in could harm Deontay Johnson's target volume a little bit. It could, to be fair, change the ADOT. Like, they just might have Johnson running more routes downfield and maybe his target volume stays the same, which admittedly would be a problem for my narrative on the whole thing. But I think what instead will happen is you'll see more targets go to Juju Smith-Schuster and Chase Claypool, even James Washington for the number of snaps that he's out there. So, yeah, I think you'll see more downfield throws, basically. I think this might hurt Ebron, too.
Oh, okay. All right. So the good notes there, especially on Deontay Johnson. You have with the artificially inflated target count with Roethlisberger back there. Mason Rudolph at least has the functioning arm, like we mentioned there. So something to keep in mind for your Steelers approach for DFS or for season long heading into Sunday. Before we get on to our next game, we got a message from our friends over at BetMGM. Sports bettors know that magic happens when you turn a hunch into action and apply the right amount of expertise. That's why BetMGM has teamed up with RotoWire to offer new BetMGM subscribers a free 6-month RotoWire subscription when they place their first bet. Register on the BetMGM app or website. Use promo code ROTO, that's R-O-T-O, to claim your free subscription. Once you make your first sports wager, you'll receive a season's length of RotoWire's unmatched sports insights. Find out why BetMGM is the king of sportsbooks by signing up and placing your first bet today. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. 21 years or older of age to wager. Colorado, Indiana, New Jersey, Nevada, Tennessee, and West Virginia only. Please gamble responsibly. If you have a gambling problem, call 1-800-522-4700 in Colorado and Nevada, and 1-800-GAMBLER in New Jersey and West Virginia. If you're in Tennessee, call or text the red line at 800-889-9789. If you or someone you know has a gambling problem and wants help, call 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana. Promotional offer not available in Nevada. Moving on to our next game, we got the Cowboys going up against the Giants, kind of the undercard of the NFC East action on Sunday. Obviously, we're going to be treated to football team versus the Eagles, kind of for all the marbles on Sunday night. But this one has some intrigue as well. The Cowboys, 1.5-point favorites on the road facing up against these Giants. Looked like Michael Gallup and company kind of came to life for this Cowboys passing attack. last week. I know the Giants have a pretty solid secondary, however, certainly more solid than what the Eagles were throwing out there. So any reason for concern when it comes to some of these Cowboys pass catchers going into this one?
I don't think we should expect it to look like last week very often, where Andy Dalton has a legitimately big game. I think it's like, if the Cowboys receivers do well in this setting, it'll be kind of eking it out. It won't really be like Dalton propels this huge day for multiple people. You might worry about Amari Cooper against James Bradbury. Oddly, I wouldn't really. Like, I think that Cooper is such a good route runner that cornerback matchups don't matter as much. You can cover him with like perfect technique and stuff, and he just still can win because that's just what he's capable of. So I wouldn't really worry about him specifically. Like, if you have him, you're probably starting him. And same with CeeDee Lamb. I think he's kind of, in most weeks, he's the clear second guy behind Cooper, and I feel like that applies here as well. Even with Bradbury on Cooper, and thus nobody of importance being left on Gallup, I just think that the Giants are pretty clearly a well-schemed defense, and they've overachieved all year, which is generally the opposite of what the Eagles have been under Jim Schwartz. Like, if anything, they kind of underachieved with him, which suits the Cowboys and might explain why Dalton had a big game last week. But this time, the defense will play well for its part. It won't lay down. And so I would expect Gallup to fall back to earth, especially. And I would expect Dalton to have maybe like an extra turnover or two relative to last week.
Okay, yeah, so definitely a tougher setup than it was a week ago, going up against the Eagles. And then for the Giants side of this, obviously the Cowboys have had some defensive struggles. They force a lot of turnovers, obviously, on Sunday against the Eagles, but that's not always sticky week over week. So what are you expecting from this Giants offense heading into this one?
Well, it should be a decent enough setup. I mean, Daniel Jones is bad, and I don't know if his hamstring is making him worse than he usually is, but receivers like Darius Slayton and Sterling Shepard can definitely get open here. If Evan Ingram is able to play or whatever, he can hurt this defense too. It's just, you know, what do you do about, you know, Jason Garrett, Freddie Kitchens calling a Daniel Jones offense? It's hard to feel good about any of it, but the receivers are good, and the defense, it's like if there's a limiting factor on the Giants offense, it probably won't have anything to do with the Dallas defense. It'll just be like, this is the unprovoked failure that the Giants are capable of.
Yeah, no, they absolutely are. And, you know, the personnel in and of itself, not overly impressive. And Daniel Jones kind of like just lowers the overall ceiling, especially when he's not at his most mobile. Obviously, he got sacked a bunch last week in Baltimore. I don't expect him to be able to move the ball on the ground as well. So that's one less thing for the Cowboys defense to really be stressed by. Let's go over to the Falcons going up against the Bucs. Bucs 6-point favorites in this one. The Buccaneers, of course, took care of business in, I would say, impressive fashion. I mean, they really just blew the doors off the Lions in that Saturday early game last week. Falcons deftly found a way to lose, snatching that sweet defeat from the jaws of victory against the sleepwalking Chiefs last week. How are you expecting this one to shape up?
Well, I think it's kind of risky to get used to this good Matt Ryan. Not that Matt Ryan is bad, it's just that when he doesn't have Julio, games like last week, I think, are pretty clearly on the higher range of his outcomes, and you don't want to presume a future based on that outcome. So I'm worried about Ryan falling back down to earth. But when I look at the individual matchups for the Atlanta pass catchers, assuming Julio is out, I still think you can feel really good about Calvin Ridley. And I don't normally, as a rule, feel that way when Julio is out. Sometimes I actually worry, like, Matt Ryan becomes so bad in this game that it negates the target share advantage that Calvin Ridley gets by Julio sitting out. I don't think this is one case, because the Tampa Bay defense has been pretty aggressive with its man coverage calls all year. And specifically, they try to put Carlton Davis on the other team's number one receiver as a rule. And I don't think I don't even think Carlton Davis is quite so good that they need to feel that way. Like, he's not as good as like a Jaire Alexander corner, let alone a Jalen Ramsey one. But they always try to put him on the number one receiver and without much help and in man coverage. And that's why he got torched so bad by Tyreek Hill. So if you call a defense like that against Calvin Ridley, you won't get the 80-yard touchdowns that you do with Tyreek Hill. but you will give up like 175 yards on 15 targets or something, because Carlton Davis is a good corner, but basically no one can cover Calvin Ridley man-to-man press coverage, and it's unfair to expect Davis to do it. So if they expect Davis to do it, there's a chance that Ridley torches them for it. It's just a question of, like, can anyone else in the Atlanta offense do anything at all? And I think the answer is closer to no than yes.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of just shaping up to be the Ridley show.
Yeah, like, you might see, I don't know, you could see maybe Ryan throwing for like 240 yards on like 35 attempts, but Ridley gets 160 of those. If they put him in single press coverage against Carlton Davis, Ridley will win that, and it's just that simple. So they could alter their defense and try to do some double team stuff, try to give Carlton Davis some help, and if so, then I think the wheels might fall off the Falcons offense, but I don't know if it's in the nature of the Buccaneers to call it that way.
Okay, all right, that definitely adds up. And then on the Buccaneers side of this one, we do expect them to play to win this one, because they have a game advantage right now for the fifth spot on the Rams. But the Rams obviously have that straight up tiebreaker. So they'll want to make sure they secure the victory in this one. Brady obviously played pretty well, or extremely well, last week before getting pulled, just to preserve him. All these Bucs receivers seem to be playing at an extremely high level. Gronk is even looking really, really strong here down the stretch. So is there much that the Falcons will be able to do defensively to slow the Bucs?
Maybe more than we'd guess. I don't want to say they're a good defense exactly, but I think a couple things are definitely true. That one being, like, maybe this defense isn't good in its talent level. Certainly the pass rush is crap. The defensive line, aside from Jarrett, not very good. But it's also true that they were probably worse under Dan Quinn than their talent level really dictated. Like, they probably underachieved with Quinn, and at the very least under Raheem Morris now, they're overachieving, which it doesn't make them go from bad to good, but you can't just assume they're the same chumps they used to be. And I think Tampa Bay, you know, with Tom Brady being the state that he's in, he needs to have a chump as on the other side to play well. Like, he needs to have a chump opponent, or he needs to have so much help that he may as well be playing against a chump opponent. Like, he needs a helpless opponent to play well. I don't care that he had a big game last week. The Lions are helpless. Brady bullied them like you could have predicted he would. Sure. I'm only surprised that they didn't run the score up more. But Blaine Gabbert putting up the exact same numbers, I think, made clear what was going on. It's like, this is not a real game. The Falcons, you know, it's not something new for defensive teams, or for defensive players especially, to, like, come alive for Raheem Morris. Like, he's been an interim head coach before, and I feel like this happened at the last time too. But he's going to have that defense playing better than it did under Quinn. They might have a legitimate number one cornerback in A.J. Terrell by complete accident on the part of Thomas Dimitroff, who basically just got up there who was it that they got sniped on? C.J. Henderson. The Rams took Henderson, and Dimitroff did that thing where he just leaves the position category tab open, and then it auto drafts the next one, and that's how they got A.J. Terrell. But it looks like he's good. And Isaiah Oliver, it's like he's not fast enough to play outside bump and run coverage, but he seems to be doing okay as, like, this. They're almost like making him into a Kenny Vaccaro or something like that, which more suits his athleticism. So they've got some ability to give good reps at corner, and that alone is enough for me to start wondering if Tom Brady's going to struggle a bit, because I don't think he can play at a compelling level. He can just enter circumstances where he has every advantage, and if he doesn't, then the whole thing is up to some sort of question, even though I still expect them to win.
Okay, no, that's an interesting angle that you have on this one, and then, you know, how it relates to maybe how the Falcons could be a bit of an inconvenience for this Buccaneers offense as they need to finish the season strong and get the win in Week 17. And then from a fantasy angle, it looks like Ronald Jones should be trending towards a return. I know he practiced on Wednesday, so. If he is back, you feel good about starting him. You're not worried about, you know, Leonard Fournette, LeSean McCoy, Keyshawn Vaughn taking over. You think that Jones kind of recaptures his role?
It was so great to see Keyshawn Vaughn get three carries for 30 yards and run the way that I remembered him being at Vanderbilt when I ranked him as the number one rookie running back in the class. I'm glad to be vindicated on that by last week's events.
That's stamped.
I think Ronald Jones is like, I don't know what the COVID part means. Like if he's himself, I basically like the setup just because he has the game trajectory advantage being a starting running back on a favored team with like the clearly better defense in the matchup. So I like the situational details for him enough that I don't really think specifically about the matchup, which might actually be pretty challenging. I otherwise am just like, I'm just deferring to the fact that like Leonard Fournette clearly isn't good, and Keyshawn Vaughn, maybe he's fine, but he's not as good as Ronald Jones. Like Ronald Jones it's been a weird year, and he's probably always going to be a little bit goofy, but he's pretty clearly closer to like that Miles Sanders category of talent than he is like the Kenyon Drake category. And not that he's different kind of players. I'm just thinking of like, well, who's like the running back 10 or 11 or whatever? And it's like, that's Ronald Jones, and Fournette, whatever he is like 40, 45 and, yes. You know, Vaughn similar.
Yes. Yeah. So as long as Jones is himself, you know, that we should expect him to turn in a start worthy performance. And then the Falcons backfield, obviously a mess right now, even coming off of some decent showing by like Ito Smith. Do you feel okay starting any of those guys against this Bucs run defense?
Somebody's probably in a bad enough spot that it's the right call, but you don't really want to end up there.
No, you certainly do not. All right, let's go over to the NFC North. We got the Packers going up against the Bears. This one's in Chicago. Packers 5.5-point favorites in this one. So things set up extremely well for the Packers. They do need to win. But they do have the tiebreaker, of course, over the Saints. So that's worth noting that the Saints and Seahawks both 11-4, Packers 12-3 heading into this one. Packers sitting atop the table, of course, in the NFC. But they can also kind of do good on two fronts by not only winning and securing that number one spot, but also making things a lot more complicated for the Chicago Bears, their divisional rivals. Of course, the Packers playing great right now. I mean, their performance on Sunday, you knew that once the elements kicked in that you figured that the Packers were going to be able to take advantage of that one against a team from Tennessee. But it was still fun to watch nonetheless. And, you know, Devontae Adams having an incredible game, Rodgers playing at that MVP level. What do you think happens here Sunday against a Bears team that needs a win?
Well, going to Chicago and stirring up, you know, not like the rivalry exactly, but just kind of that history of animosity between them, that tends to bring lower scoring and like closer games as a general rule. I don't know if that rule applies to a team like the Packers as they are this particular year, which is to say, you know, automatic. They have this thing going on where everyone seems to know where the ball is going, but no one can stop it. And I think his talent evaluation abilities are questionable, and I question some of his other decisions that he's made. But as a play caller, Matt LaFleur is the best in the league right now. Like, dang. And specifically as the scheming setup, it's like there's no analogous case in the league right now. I guess it was like, I don't know, maybe Michael Thomas last year was the closest thing to Devontae Adams this year, where and I think Devontae Adams is actually the better player. So I'm more impressed with the way he's done it. There's a lot more touchdowns, a lot more big plays, you'll notice, than yes. Michael Thomas in 2019. And part of that is Devontae Adams being as good as he is and Rodgers being as good as he is. Part of it, too, though, is LaFleur just keeps setting up these things that defenses – I don't know if it's like there's little adjustments week to week and the defenses are always like a step behind. I don't know if it's more like they've just got a formula that no one can seem to stop. With the secondary pieces in the offense as bad as they are, it basically doesn't make any sense that Devontae Adams has been efficient as he's been this year, and it's because LaFleur is the difference. If you have Mike McCarthy running this offense, this is the same output as 2018 Aaron Rodgers. Like, that's the degree to which I think LaFleur is making the difference here. So if he doesn't have an off day with his game plan, I don't really know what the Bears can do to slow them, you know? So I I can imagine the Bears defense playing pretty well. Maybe Rodgers has an off day, but I don't think LaFleur will have an off day. And I think Mitch Trubisky is still hilariously bad, and this would probably be a good setting for him to make that clear to anyone who has somehow been confused otherwise in the past.
Yeah, I mean, the last couple of weeks, you know, again, it's good to kind of just get out in front of it. But yeah, like the Bears offense has looked good the last few weeks, but they've played all these terrible defenses. I mean, if they don't score 40 on the Jaguars, then you're concerned.
They fixed Mitch. Mitch is good now. Just in time for a contract extension. Yeah, definitely, guys. You should do that.
I would have to imagine that that's very frustrating for Bears fans. It's like, why is he doing this now? We've already tried to get ourselves to move on. Why is this happening? But
can you imagine speaking with your own name to give an article comment that maybe the Bears should sign Mitch? You are a fool. Delete your bylines.
Yes. God, yes. But what does that mean for is Sunday just one big regression to the mean potentially in that case?
Yeah, because he had it. So he didn't even play well last week. He still looked pretty ugly last week. And then the week before that, it was the Texans and their, sub CFL defense. You could just see this is not an NFL game. This looks like a preseason game at most. And the Packers defense isn't even great or anything. If they don't shadow Allen Robinson with Jair Alexander, then Allen Robinson is going to absolutely pummel Kevin King. But I don't think that it's enough. It's like Mitch will be so bad that some of those opportunities will be missed, that some of those Allen Robinson opportunities will be missed. And, as much as guys like Darnell Mooney, even Anthony Miller, have some promise, it's like they can't make up the difference. They can't carry Mitch while he's dragging down Allen Robinson. And if you believe in regression to the mean, I think you do have to kind of just assume that this is a setting where it happens, because with Mitch, you know it's going to happen. And this is an actual NFL defense, even if it's not great.
No, exactly. So I'm looking for the Bears to take a step back offensively in this one. And that probably ends up being the difference going up against the Packers, who will, if you're having to keep up with Aaron Rodgers the way that he's playing right now, I don't like your chances, especially when you're Mitch Trubisky. Let's go Saints, Panthers. This one in the afternoon slate for Sunday. The big fantasy question out of this one with Mike Davis being doubtful and Christian McCaffrey being out. Rodney Smith season. Let's say.
Yeah. Well, he's kind of interesting, and I don't know if listeners have picked up on this over the years, but I think, John, it's safe to say that we have a little bit of a truther thing going on with the Minnesota running backs, Rodney Smith and the guy who broke his leg four times or whatever.
Shannon Brooks?
Yeah. I remember thinking, man, a couple of years ago, thinking, Shannon Brooks is good, because Rodney Smith is kind of okay, and Shannon Brooks is way better. And then So Rodney Smith getting on the Panthers as an undrafted guy and more or less doing the same numbers as Mike Davis when they would shuffle him in, that was the last thing, the last kind of catnip I needed to be exposed to, because it was just I obviously didn't remember the guy's name enough just now, but I remembered thinking, hey, that one Minnesota guy is probably good still.
Yes.
I'm back on it. But no, in any case, I actually do think, Rodney Smith could be one of those guys in the NFL who does Mike Davis stuff in a different year. You don't, especially if you have an offense that's structured the way the Panthers are and functions at a basic level of competence, you can pretty much put any running back in there as long as they can stay viable on the passing snaps, and you get numbers kind of like Mike Davis, kind of like Rodney Smith. But in this matchup, it's bad setup for him, because the Saints defense is just quite good, especially in that front seven. The Panthers, they got some things going for them, but they're not like a serious comparison to the Saints in terms of talent. So maybe if they were going against a bad defense, maybe if they were going against the Raiders, I'd be like Rodney Smith day. But in this one, I'm worried about him finishing with 10 carries for 28 yards and four catches for 20 yards or something.
Yeah, I share those similar concerns. I think that Saints defense is really, really, really strong. So that doesn't set up well for the Panthers in this one. On the Saints side of things. What have been your thoughts on the Saints offense since Drew Brees' return? And you know, what does that mean for Sunday's game against the Panthers?
Well, you're, of course, starting Alvin Kamara. And like, if you have a DFS lineup, you're probably considering him too. I have to believe this is more of a Latavius Murray kind of game, especially if the Panthers offense fails to threaten the Saints defense, which that could go either way. It's like Teddy Bridgewater, he's just not good. But when you have receivers like those three, big plays can happen more easily than in other offenses. So there's always that possibility. And the bigger the game Bridgewater has, the more usage Kamara should probably get. But man, the Saints really ought to be able to just give Murray like 15 carries and still get a safe win.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too. They don't need to go max effort. They don't need to exhaust Kamara a week before the playoffs, especially if they're not going to be treated to that bye week. So yeah, like that call on Latavius Murray for this week as a value running back potentially. Let's go Colts, Jaguars. Colts 14-point favorites in this one. Colts, you know, they had the Steelers on the ropes last week for what could have been a really, really huge win for them. Ended up not working out, of course, with the Steelers coming back and getting the victory over them on Sunday at Heinz Field. But luckily for the Colts and their, you know, playoff aspirations, they get to play the Jaguars. And the Jaguars are actively tanking. So this should be a slam dunk for the Colts. But as far as their production, where is it going to be coming from?
Well, I would guess that any of the Colts running backs could produce against this Jaguars defense, especially with, like you said, the tanking that they are very clearly doing and very competently. But yes. I think that, if I don't know how much work they want to give Taylor, but Taylor's here and he looks insanely good. He already looks like one of the best running backs in the league just over the past few weeks. It's just a question of like how many carries do they want to give him? And there might not be a need to give him any carries like Nyheim Hines. I can't emphasize enough, anyone who thought that he was better than Jonathan Taylor, it's like you got to learn this stuff. Like that's a big one to get wrong. That's an easy one to get right. And it's one of those times you're trying to get it wrong on some level, whether you realize it or not. But he against the Jaguars, yes, he can do something. But I'm a little bit worried about it being like 12 carries for 80 yards and a touchdown for Taylor, 10 carries for 65 yards for Hines, and then like 8 carries for, 50 yards for Jordan Wilkins, something like that.
Okay, so a bit of a divided up workload, but still clicking when it comes to Taylor. It's just
it should be a blowout, Backups play in blowouts.
That's absolutely true, but they got to get there, and to get to the blowout, you imagine that Taylor would have a big part of it.
He'll go off if they keep feeding him.
No question. As far as these Colts pass catchers are concerned, T.Y. Hilton come back down to earth a little bit last week. Michael Pittman obviously still in the mix there. How confident are you in those guys going up against the Jags?
I'm confident that I think, it's kind of like the running backs. It's like if you just tell me who's getting the targets, I'll just say, yeah, they'll be good. Pittman, Pascal, Hilton. Doesn't matter. I would put the money on Hilton, I guess, if I had to, just because I'm a bit of a T.Y. Hilton truther. I've always been a really big fan of him, and I'm not quite as high on Pittman as a prospect as most people. So I kind of view it as like one T.Y. Hilton and then 2A is Pascal or 2A is Pittman, whatever, 2B is Pascal. It's kind of like whoever gets it is just the one that the defense leaves alone and could be those other two guys. It could be Hilton. I don't really know.
Okay. All right. So that definitely checks out. But yeah, Hilton should be the main pass catching guy to target for your DFS lineups. On the other side of this one, for the Chark investors, for Chenault investors, we are going back to Mike Glennon for this one. So thoughts
yeah, man.
There?
I can't really recommend it because, it worked out fine enough last week, but it did not work out fine at all against the Vikings, and DJ Chark was open the entire game. So I love DJ Chark. I think Chenault could be pretty good. I think, even Colin Johnson might be pretty good if Keelan Cole walks, but even with Chark that good in my mind. I feel like Glennon can still ruin it.
Yes. Yes, he definitely can. And you know, the Colts defense is going to come to play on Sunday, of course. So, yeah, I don't think that the Jags are going to be able to move the ball a whole lot in Indianapolis. Let's go to the other AFC South showdown. We got the Titans traveling to Houston to face the Texans. Titans 7.5-point favorites in this one.
Yeah, you got to put Derrick Henry's over under for yardage at like 208.5 because you know, I would have normally been like, they'll probably save him for the playoffs. So he'll get like 80 yards and 2 touchdowns against this fake team, this fake defense anyway. And that'll be that. They'll give Darrington Evans some warm up reps, something like that. But it sticks in my mind the way last year ended when Nick Chubb had the rushing title, and then the Titans just like ran up Henry's yardage count in that game to get him the title. And if he gets like 220 yards, I think he gets 2,000 on the year. And 1,000%, I think Vrabel is the kind of guy to go after something like that. And I can barely blame him. Like, this Texans defense is so bad. Like, recall that David Montgomery 80-yard touchdown, and imagine how much faster it happens with Henry. Mm. Like, with like 3 guys on his back too. Like, it's like, that's he can really go high volume, high efficient. He could set the single game rushing yardage record in this game.
Dang. Okay. I see it. You know, like you said, that this is a Texans team that just really, really can't stop anybody. And it does feel like the Titans are hell bent on getting a lot of that volume to Derrick Henry in this one. Whether or not he needs it necessarily, he's going to get it. So, yeah, love that spot for him as the RB1 this week in all likelihood. What are you looking at as far as the Texans side of this equation goes?
Well, if Henry can't set the single game rushing record, it might have to do with Deshaun Watson scoring fast enough that the Titans need to throw a little bit themselves. And of course, if they do, that's a total green light too. It's, you know, it's like a aircraft carrier of space that they have to work with in that defense. And it's, you know, AJ Brown doesn't need any help. Tannehill, I think, is basically a below average quarterback in a top 5 sort of playing situation, at least for his efficiency and things like that. And I think that Green Bay game showed how fake he is. Like, it was a wrap as soon as there was pressure on Tannehill. And by pressure, it wasn't even like the pass rush. It was he needed to do something for them to win. It was just like, nope, not an option. He's not that kind of player. Luckily for him, against a fake defense like the Texans, he can probably torch them without really even trying that hard. So he sets up fine. It's just a question of how much Deshaun forces the Titans to go toward the pass. And he could really force it. I mean, I don't know what exactly to make of this Tennessee secondary now that they've got Desmond King and Adoree Jackson in the fold. Like, those are 2 big upgrades over what they had for the first 12 weeks or whatever.
Sure.
But I don't know if any of those corners can – like, Malcolm Butler still is a 4-6 guy. Like, he's a Tampa 2 corner, and Adoree Jackson can run, but he's still not quite as athletic as Brandon Cooks, and I don't think he's as good of a corner as Cooks is a receiver. So this could be another big game in, 2 in a row for Brandon Cooks. I think after a slow week last week, Chad Hansen and Kiki Kuti also look like they could be good here. So – I think Deshaun should have options, and the Tennessee pass rush shouldn't hassle him to the point that he misses any of those options. So, I could see this being quite a bit of a shootout because, I don't know, Deshaun's really good and the Titans defense still isn't.
Yeah, the Titans really, really struggled defensively. And, you know, we, of course, saw that Sunday night against the Packers. We've seen it throughout the course of the season. So, yeah, I think there is a reason why this one checks in with an over-under of 56. Obviously, the Texans aren't going to be stopping anybody on their side of things. But, yeah, this game kind of profiles as maybe the centerpiece of kind of most of your like cash game builds, maybe for DFS, and you know you'll want to get some tournament exposure to this one as well, because I mean games with totals north of 50 this week are hard to come by, and this one, you know, strongly above it at 56 and a half,
and indoors.
Yes, yeah, it is indoors. Yeah, so yeah. Other places not so much. Let's go. We got Chargers Chiefs No Mahomes in this one. We have, the Chiefs 3.5-point underdogs at home because the Chad Henne effect back there at quarterback. We also got Clyde Edwards-Hilaire doubtful. Le'Veon Bell picked up a knee issue, apparently. Tyreek Hill and Sammy Watkins both listed as questionable at the time of this recording. Chiefs already have the number one seed stitched up as well, so that all of that explains why the line is sitting where it is. Are you going dumpster diving at all on any of these Chiefs skill guys, even with Chad Henne back there?
I don't know. I might be a little tempted by Mecole Hardman just because Casey Hayward can't run with him even a little bit. Like if Casey Hayward has to match stride with Hardman for more than 12 yards, that's a significant touchdown risk on that play. So even if Chad Henne is crap, and he is, of course, and he was even when he wasn't an old crappy quarterback like he is now, he still might be able to make that throw. I don't really like the idea of going at a team that's kind of like, I don't know how to say this right. The Chiefs have this juggernaut reputation, and there's the kind of like that deference to them, but they just don't have any of their actual nature present at this point. So right. It's just kind of like a fake game, and I don't know whether any at all of the past assumptions apply. And if they don't, then like, why would I even feel better about the Chiefs than I would like the Jaguars or something?
Yeah, no, they're not going to be putting up a truly like win viable type of product on the field on Sunday, which totally fine. They've earned the right to do that, having gone 14-1. So when it comes to the Chargers, however, what are your thoughts on them being able to take advantage of this shorthanded Chiefs team?
I can still imagine Herbert struggling a little bit just because the Chiefs are a somewhat confusing defense to go against. There's a pretty unique way that they call things, and their personnel is pretty unique, varied too. So if you're a quarterback who needs to make things pre-snap read, it's not necessarily that easy to figure it all out before the snap. And for any rookie quarterback, figuring everything out after the snap is a pretty difficult thing to do. So I can imagine Herbert struggling a little bit. What I can't really imagine is Eckler struggling, and maybe there's something weird about the flow of the game that makes it hard for them to get him going. But I just think if Eckler is going against kind of like your scout team sort as a whole, mm-hmm. I just don't think talents like him lose in settings like that unless there's some sort of other sort of complicating factor. Like, even if Herbert's bad, though, it's like that's not enough. It's like I need the whole offensive line to get injured or something like that. But yeah, I mean, maybe the Chargers don't go with that level of competitiveness. Maybe they're like, let's not overwork Eckler. This game doesn't matter. Let's see if we can get Kalen Ballage's stats up or something. Like that's the bigger risk, I guess.
Okay, all right, that definitely makes sense. And then when it comes to these Chargers pass catchers, what are you expecting here against the Chiefs?
Well, I don't know what to make of Keenan Allen. I guess, he sets up good or whatever. Fine, I guess, if he's in there. The outside receiver question is tough because they've been rotating a lot, and it's hard to figure out the usage in the first place for the outside receivers in this offense. But Mike Williams, he's their most talented one. I think Tyron Johnson is better than Jalen Guyton, but those guys split snaps. They both play two more than I would expect. I'm surprised Mike Williams doesn't play more snaps than he's been playing. But in this game, it's if I guess I would say the more Herbert struggles in this game, the more I like the chances of Williams popping up, because he seems to be who they go to when it's like, all right, we can't get Keenan Allen, we can't get Hunter Henry going. We need to just break. We need to loosen up the defense and go deep. And like, I think that's sometimes the point in the script where Williams's card comes up. But this is all very speculative talk. It's hard to see anything reliable in that entire pass catching group right now.
No, that definitely adds up as far as it's Keenan Allen show when he's healthy, and then everyone else. But it's tricky to get it figured out. And even though the Chiefs won't be at full force, this is a tricky Chargers offense to try to sort through, especially in the passing game. Let's go over to the Raiders versus the Broncos. if this game happens and nobody watches it, does it actually count?
Unfortunately, yes. And I don't know what to make of anybody in this one. I mean, there's just such goofy ass teams, and the Denver offense with Locke, it's truly a roller coaster all the time, to the point that you don't want to take matchup details for granted. Like, you don't want to be like, Drew Locke will probably be fine because Jerry Jeudy can get open against LaMarcus Joyner, and because Tim Patrick can beat Nevin Lawson, and because whatever the other KJ Hamler against the Mullen corner. I think those guys will be open or whatever. Like that actually is true, that it sets up well for each of them. But Locke's just a total wild card. I don't think it matters at all what the defense is. It's like he has his days where he's just, you know, Rex Grossman has his days where the pass is landing, and sometimes he doesn't. Like, it's just, there's not really much meaning to any of it.
I mean, that's a great comparison. And yeah, Locke, I mean, from like a long-term perspective, obviously they didn't sink a first-round pick into him. Do you think that they either draft someone or maybe bring in a vet to compete with him heading into next season?
Yeah, it would have been nice to see Cam Newton in that offense, because I think he would have done very well in it. But obviously John Elway isn't interested in that kind of quarterback. So I don't know what the veteran would look like. Maybe it would look like Chad Henne or something. I don't know. John Elway is a fool of a man, and he's not truly committed to putting together the best football team. So I think he might continue to succeed in that respect.
Yeah, no, he's batting 1,000 in that sense ever since they won the Super Bowl.
I found Trevor Siemian. What did you ever do?
There you go. All right, that's it. That's a good line there. As far as the Raiders go, they blew it basically against the Dolphins multiple times. I mean, not much else to say.
I
mean, you say it more towards their defense, I suppose. The offense, still pretty fun. I mean, you got Darren Waller still doing well. Nelson Aguilar has been one of the more pleasant surprises of this entire season. How do they set up against this Broncos defense on the road?
Well, the Broncos were down to like their sixth cornerback last week. I guess like Michael Ojemudia and Devontae Bosby. That's not great. And Michael Ojemudia is pretty toolsy. Bosby isn't. He can't run with like Bryan Edwards, let alone Aguilar. So that should be open. It's just that you don't really get a lot of direct man-to-man matchups in this defense. It's like you get a lot of zones that may alter over the course of a game or over the course of a season, and you just kind of need the quarterback to read things right after the snap, before the snap. And I think Carr generally will be fine there, especially with Fangio does not have a full clip to work with. You know, like it would be one thing if he had all his guys, if he had Bryce Callahan and AJ Bouye, then I'd be worried for Carr. But Carr can probably figure this out. He's a guy who's gotten this far largely by doing fine in games like these, you know, circumstances that don't matter. He looks just good enough that you never quite summon the resolve to just cut him or bench him or whatever. So a guy like that largely survives by, you know, meeting minimum demands in settings like these. And I think he'll probably see to that, I guess.
Yep. That's about all you can say there. Let's go Cards, Rams. We got the Cardinals -3 in this one. Looks like Kyler Murray will be good to go for this one. Jared Goff, much more of a question mark. It doesn't look like it he was officially ruled out after undergoing thumb surgery. So we're going to be treated to John Wolford and with Blake Bortles as the backup in what is actually a fairly important game for these Los Angeles Rams.
Yeah, man, that's pretty wild. Malcolm Brown is, I guess, going to have to carry the team.
Yes.
There's like, who even, I don't know who their fourth, is it John Kelly? Has he been called up? Anyway, it's not good. Like, Sean McVay has
Raymond Calais and Xavier Jones.
Oh, right, Xavier Jones. Still not great. Not good news. I don't know where this is headed, but John, it wasn't that long ago that Wake Forest had a certain quarterback controversy on its hands. John Walford ultimately won and did fairly well for himself. But for a minute there, they weren't sure that it was fair to take the other side that actually Wake Forest should start Kendall Hinton. So that's
the listeners know who Kendall Hinton is now. So,
yeah, luckily yes. We don't need to explain who he is. But that's who John Walford was in like a really close quarterback competition with before he took that starting job. It doesn't open and shut mean that he's bad. And Hinton was a totally viable college quarterback. So it's not like he didn't have that Denver game at Wake Forest. Yeah. But he was still Kendall Hinton, you know? And that's not great. But then just the same, Jared Goff sucks. So I don't know what – like maybe – you know, Walford can move a little bit. So it would be funny and not terribly shocking if the Rams offense just looked a lot different and had a bunch of like – bootleg trickery that the Cardinals did not see on tape at any point in McVay's coaching tenure. So they just had no I wouldn't be surprised if Walford has a good first half, just kind of getting botched coverages by the Cardinals because they're totally caught off guard by McVay's play calls. But if so, they'll need to immediately, you know, go into the bunker at halftime because the Cardinals can adjust to simple stuff like that at halftime. And then they need to go Malcolm Brown mode, which, you know, maybe they get over the finish line. But, man, that is a difficult escort mission they have there. Even if Murray's bad, and I always expect Cliff Kingsbury to get outsmarted on offense. Like he's terrible, man. Let me ask a quick question, John. Do you think that Chip Kelly would have ever been fired if Kyler Murray was his quarterback?
Man, yeah, that's...
Cliff sucks. And because Kyler Murray is an insane talent, people are taking, like, cautious approaches. Like, oh, maybe he'll learn. Just try to think about Cliff Kingsbury the way you would very simply if Kyler Murray's rushing yardage didn't exist. It's not difficult. You do that, you look at what's left, and it's like, oh, my God, this is garbage. It's not a difficult conclusion to reach. But because Kyler Murray is so good, people are like hypnotized into being like, maybe Cliff is setting him up. No, he's not. Cliff is undermining every aspect of Kyler Murray's play, and it's Kyler Murray who's keeping him employed. I'm getting a little bit triggered by watching Kyler Murray play injured for a guy who would get fired if it weren't for Kyler Murray being on the field, just so that guy can stay employed and make Kyler Murray's entire career go to waste. I really hope I'm wrong about this stuff, but I'm sick of the Cliff show. And if Kyler Murray having a terrible game gets in on the hot seat, then as a dynasty owner of Kyler Murray, I would actually take that scenario. I really would like to see them fire that guy.
Yeah, no, it's crazy how quickly it's all worn off as far as, you know, Cliff Kingsbury kind of entering the league as his hot shot, you know, gonna change the way that offense is played in the league and really going to try to or get the ultimate results out of Kyler Murray. But it's like Kyler Murray's kind of doing it on his own because of how poorly Kingsbury's plans have really translated to the NFL. So, yeah, it has been definitely extremely frustrating. And, you know, if the Cardinals find their way out of the postseason, I think that, you know, Kingsbury could enter the season next year with his seat pretty warm. Let's go Seahawks, Niners. Seahawks, you know, I saw some discourse on Twitter about, you know, it's been smart to bench Russell Wilson over the last few weeks. I don't know what teams you have out there where, like, that's something you feel really great doing, where you're just, like, that loaded at quarterback in a 1QB format to really feel comfortable benching Wilson. But I know that end of the day, the results haven't been great from him of late. Do you think that changes at all Sunday against the Niners?
I don't know. It's a tough matchup, and the 49ers are going to play with, you know, it's going to be a fiery game on their part. And normally I would look at a team as talented as the Seahawks with, you know, quarterback, wide receiver trio like they have, and I would say it doesn't matter how hard the defense plays. Like, the talent is going to win here. The problem is the 49ers have a lot of talent in the secondary too. So it'd be one thing if they were just down to backups or something. But if you have Sherman, Verrett, Emmanuel Mosley, Kaywan Williams, that's as good of a four-corner rotation as any team in the league. And, you know, even if the Seahawks have more to play for and even if they're the better team generally, I feel like the 49ers with that kind of personnel are the kind of defense that can really make the game difficult anyway. And if you know, 6 points is what the line is now. It was 6.5. I know how bad the 49ers quarterbacks are. It's, you know, I'm as frustrated by that as anybody. But Garoppolo was bad too. You know, this has been more of a constant than we might, you know, reflexively acknowledge with the 49ers. They always have bad quarterback play. So Beathard or Mullins being out there alone, yeah, they're worse than Garoppolo, but I don't know if it's enough for me to fundamentally flip the whole take on the narrative. I think it's more similar to most Seahawks 49ers games than we might suspect. And if that's the case, then yeah, I expect it to be close, especially since it's in San Francisco. I just don't know what the 49ers can do to actually make it close. Apparently Jeff Wilson is just the man. Maybe he'll do it. Maybe Ayuk steps up a little bit. Maybe Kittle does Hulk mode on them. I don't really know. But I do think it'll be a pretty close game, and I kind of would be, I don't know, 46 is the over-under. That's pretty low, so I don't want to say it's lower yet. But I'm not super optimistic for the higher range either.
No, definitely not. And, you know, that making matters a little bit trickier for the Seahawks, you know, Dwayne Brown, Brandon Schell, and Mike Iupati are all on the injury report as well. So, you know, 60% of your offensive line playing at less than 100%, that's definitely not a great setup going up against this Niners front, even if it is missing some of its star power. This one could still be tricky for the Seahawks, of course. Anything else to add here before we move on to our last game?
Yeah.
All righty. Here we go. Football team versus Eagles. We obviously know that the football team parted ways with Dwayne Haskins earlier in the week after a tough outing Sunday against the Panthers, among other things, whereas the Eagles, I think a lot of people, myself included, expected them to really take care of business against Dallas. Didn't quite happen that way. Some turnovers were ended up kind of sinking the Eagles there. But yeah, this is a huge matchup. We got the football team right now sitting in the lead of the NFC East, but the Eagles are obviously still potential to play spoiler, even though they can't win the division anymore. They were eliminated with that loss, but you know, I think you could definitely argue that they're going to come to play here, and that they can, you know, be served by some further evaluation of Jalen Hurts in this one going up against the football team. So what are your expectations here?
Well, if Terry McLaurin is out again, then I don't know why the Eagles are like the underdog here. Washington is still bad. You know, it's like, well, just because they're at the lead of the NFC East with their 6-9 record doesn't mean we need to start treating them like default favorites. It's still a bad situation that they're in. So Jalen Hurts probably doesn't set up that great here. I mean, the Washington front four is really devastating, and the Eagles have had offensive line issues a lot of the year. That's probably going to be a stressor on them. The cornerbacks for Washington are well positioned, certainly. Like, they're not – maybe Ronald Darby is just kind of a product of the system. Kendall Fuller isn't. He's legitimately good. And either way, product of the system or not, Ronald Darby is still in the system. It still persists, so we have to assume he'll play at a level that he has for the most part all year. So I don't really see any of these Eagles receivers getting a good look at it. And it just doesn't look like a good setup to me. I don't think they're playing that well, that they're not producing that well, I should say. So Jalen Hurts had a couple just like lucky bounces in his first two starts. We saw the correction start to occur last week. Unfortunately for him, and like not any fault of him, I think this is a setting where he just is likely to deal with more bad luck. So he can still get the win, and the running should be a pretty constant thing. Like, I don't worry about his running ability being removed from the script. It's more like you worry about him falling apart as a passer. So the Eagles should try to make this a ground game, and I think they will, and I think it'll work. But that would be less likely if McLaurin is out there. McLaurin can torch Darius Slay, whoever else, whatever they try to do. And I still think Steven Sims is good. I'm pretty sure he is, actually, and that Ron Rivera is just not good at knowing bad players from good ones. But I don't think he's enough to carry Taylor Heinicke over the finish line. And by the way, I do think Heinicke is better than Alex Smith and Kyle Allen. And whereas I had a problem with Washington starting either of them over Haskins, I'm okay with Heinicke starting. I actually think he might be pretty good.
Okay. All right. So Taylor Heinicke time. Very exciting. For a potential NFC East crown, Tyler Heinicke.
He's the right man for a NFC East playoff run.
Amen. Yeah, week 17, brother. You know, bring it on. I'm very excited. So this one actually, at the very least, will be a pretty entertaining cap to the regular season. Once again, we got the football team going up against the Eagles. The football team able to clinch the division with a victory in that one. But that's going to round things out for our Week 17 preview. Mario and I will keep going forward with our NFL podcast during the off season and through the playoffs as well. We'll start to get you guys ready for your dynasty drafts so that we're going to get the combine, position by position breakdowns of the incoming draft class. A lot to get to, a really fun class between the, you know, a loaded group of quarterbacks, running back group that is going to have a lot of varying opinions on how it should be ordered, and the receivers. Oh, man, we just continue to be so spoiled with the receiver classes. I mean, going back to the 2019 class, 2020 obviously has been unbelievable, and we're going to get blessed with another really strong crop of rookie receivers in 2021 as well. So for Mario Puig, I'm John McKechnie. Thank you for listening to us here on the RotoWire NFL podcast. Again, we will keep things rolling through the offseason, get all of your dynasty and draft needs covered. Have a happy new year, everybody.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.